Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today's special guest is Rob Briner. Rob is Professor of Organizational Psychology at Queen Mary University, London. He's also Visiting Professor at Birkbeck University, and he's co-founder and scientific director of the Center for Evidence-Based Management. Rob, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you doing today?
Thanks, Simon. I'm doing well. Thank you very much. I'm doing all right, yeah.
Good. So I really wanted to do a deep dive into evidence-based work. As I said in our kind of pre-podcast chat, I'm a bit of a critic of it because often I see evidence-based practice done pretty badly, particularly in the kind of area I work in, which is coaching. There's a lot of very kind of weak evidence-based stuff. So tell me kind of first why you got interested in it and your thoughts on evidence-based practice, why it's important to you.
Sure. So I got interested in evidence-based practice probably 25 plus years ago now when I was doing my PhD, and part of my PhD was looking at things like stress at work as a for example. And the more I looked at the literature, I felt that a lot of the claims that were being made about what stress was and its effects in the workplace, if I looked closer at the scientific evidence, it didn't really seem to be particularly backed up. And this is stuff academics were saying, not practitioners in particular. So I got quite interested in the idea. There's often quite a big gap between the claims that are made about stuff,
yeah,
and the best available scientific evidence. So that was part of it. Then I also got interested in it because I was teaching on a master's program in organizational psychology at the University of Sheffield, again, where I was doing my PhD. And I quite often meet these students. So years later, I meet these students and say, how's it going? How's your job? What are you doing as a work psychologist? Are you using all the stuff we taught you, or is it helpful? And they will mostly go, no, we're not using that stuff. So, okay, so you're a psychologist, but you're not kind of drawing on science very much. So I think for a long time, I kind of started blaming, I mostly was blaming practitioners and others for not following the science. And then over time, I think I came to realize it's obviously much more complicated than that. And there's reasons, good reasons, why people don't or can't use the science. And more importantly, I guess, or equally importantly, is that when I think about evidence-based practice, it's much, much more than just the science. It's about other sources of evidence as well. So now I think it's the reasons why we in general collectively aren't very good at evidence-based practice is because it's one of those things I think that's not kind of hard as in complicated, but it's just difficult to do and requires quite a lot of attention and effort. And most of us are not rewarded for making high-quality decisions. We're mostly rewarded for doing stuff. So it's the stuff that gets done. Is that stuff any good? Is it helping? We don't know. But well done. You did the stuff. So I think now, in many fields, from medicine to policing to policymaking to architecture to finance, it's the same deal. It's like, can we make better informed decisions about what it is we're dealing with and what we can do about it?
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. I mean, my experience of it is that it becomes, there's quite a lot of pseudoscience being used, and like evidence-based almost gets tacked on as a kind of an extra to kind of explain something or take in a certain direction. So it's often kind of manipulated, and it's not like, it doesn't actually, like you say, it doesn't kind of work in practice to kind of make things better. It works for certain people's agendas.
Yeah. There's often a kind of post-decision, post-hoc rationalization. There's often a lot of confirmation bias, people searching for evidence to support the thing they already want to do, and also very often very narrow definitions of what constitutes good quality or relevant evidence and data. So, yeah, certainly, I think in all those fields I've mentioned, that absolutely happens. People want to do stuff anyway. They scrabble around for justification, and one thing they might look to is the evidence. But it's kind of, they've started in the wrong place. You don't do stuff and then work out later if it's supported. Yeah, you start off considering the evidence, as I say, both for the problem opportunity and for if you find one, what you can do about that.
And what do you consider evidence? Tell us, our audience, kind of what consists of evidence.
Yeah. So a traditional definition or traditionalist definition going back to medicine over 30 years ago of evidence-based practice would include at least three or four sources of evidence. One is stakeholder perspectives. So in the case of medicine, that would be obviously very much be the patient and the family. In the case of evidence-based management, that would be the employees and senior management. In the case of policymakers, that might be the government and the citizens. So the stakeholders, who has invested interest in it? What are their views and opinions? That's the first source. The second source is the practitioner's own expertise. So what do you bring as someone who works in this field based on your history and your experience? So what can you draw on there? The third source is if you like, data from the context organization. So again, in the case of a patient, it might be something like diagnostic tests, what's going on with them internally or however you measure it. In the case of management, it might be data from the organization. The fourth area is scientific evidence. What's the published or the best available scientific evidence about this issue or topic or whatever it is you're trying to deal with? So there's at least four sources, but I'll add on to that as well. It's also a lot about critical thinking.
Yeah.
It's also about having theory and kind of models of how things work, because often the evidence doesn't tell you very, very well. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. So it's based on other things as well. And I'm actually quite, as it were, open. I think as long as the evidence or data or information you've got is reasonable quality or good quality, reliable and trustworthy, and it's relevant, I think anything goes. Some people talk about, who study history, talk about as historians, who may be going back hundreds of years, what counts as historical evidence? Well, potentially anything you can get hold of that's reliable and trustworthy. Similarly, in a court of law, what counts as evidence? Well, it could be witness statements, it could be forensic stuff, it could be CCTV, it could be all kinds of things. But as long as it's reasonably trustworthy and it's reasonably relevant, then it counts.
Yeah, I mean, so that's very interesting. Already we're in a much kind of richer mix and from what I usually see. I mean, what I usually see is kind of a reductionist approach where we're only talking about kind of replicable studies or science, and they're usually kind of not done very well, and they need to kind of produce some kind of measurement. All the kind of other opinions, the expertise, the kind of a subjective kind of knowledge is kind of left out, but you include that as evidence.
Absolutely. And not, you're right. So often it's fairly narrow forms of science or types of science are considered relevant, almost irrespective of what the question is. So me, and for a lot, I guess for any researcher, you know, the answer to your question sort of depends on the question. So in other words, sometimes quantitative evidence is really important, sometimes it's completely useless. Sometimes qualitative data is completely useless, sometimes it's the only thing that will answer your question. So it depends on the question, but there is a tendency to favor some kinds of things like randomized control trials or experiments, sort of irrespective of the context. So some forms of I guess scientific evidence are seen as more valid, and typically some forms of other kinds of evidence are, but it always depends on your question. And the other reason for getting these other sources of evidence, one reason is it's partly as a triangulation thing, but it's also partly to contextualize. So let's say you have a randomized control trial of some kind of intervention in some sort of context which is trying to improve children's reading ability. Fine. You've done this intervention. It's been done in two or three countries. Maybe it's been replicated two or three times. That's great. That's fine. And maybe it shows it's effective in some ways. However, if you then try and take that scientific evidence as an example and apply it to another context, you might say, well, actually, now we've spoken to stakeholders. Now we've looked at the data for this setting in this country. And actually, it may be a great piece of scientific evidence, but you know what? It just does not apply to our setting. And that's the kind of nuance or the richness you mentioned that's often missing in evidence-based practice. It is one of its strengths is by pulling together, contextualizing, triangulating these different sources of information and data.
Yeah. The other kind of question I kind of worry about with evidence-based work is, and you know, not the way you're doing it, to be honest, but the way kind of I see it in the kind of a more popular kind of realms is, you know, I'm quite a fan of Nicholas Rose's kind of work, a sociologist, and he talks about numbers being used as a kind of tool for governance and control, and about the kind of, you know, we talk about the quantifiable life, that everything has to be measured. And we're moving more and more into this kind of data-driven, target culture, metric-driven kind of world where we measure our steps, we measure how long we kind of sit down. Everything is becoming measured. And there's a sort of a byproduct of kind of this industry in a sense, which is kind of doing something to us socially. What's your kind of thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think there is. And I think it's easy to be fooled by numbers in all kinds of ways. And for me, crucially, it depends what you think those numbers are telling you. What do they mean? So, you know, there's a whole issue like reliability and validity of measurement, but also, is it helping answer your question or understand an issue or understand a problem? Yes, sometimes it is, but you need a lot of other kinds of data and information and evidence and theory and insight and imagination and creativity, lots of other things to make sense of. Okay, we've got a load of numbers, so what? And the same applies in, say, businesses where you might have key performance indicators for a business unit or for employees. You can collect all the numbers you like. Very often it turns out they're a bit useless. They're useless because they're not very accurate measures of things you want and to measure. And even if they are, it may be they're unrelated to how well the organization is performing. So everyone pats themselves on the back for having collected all this KPI data, all these numbers. But in the end, they're next to useless. They're not really telling anything important or useful. And there is that issue that somehow there's something quite beguiling and compelling about numbers that people tend to assume they're sort of intrinsically meaningful. And of course, they're not. You need to think about it and use other sources of information as well.
And, you know, I worked in the health sector. I was a general nurse and a psychiatric nurse and a family therapist. I spent my formative years in that sector. And when evidence-based nursing came kind of big, I think it was the 80s, it started being talked about. And it was good, like, you know, we were starting to kind of really think about how infection control and, you know, I could see some real positives from it, you know. And then it kind of got kind of went a bit crazy because you've got all this target culture then. So it was like waiting list in the A&E department was 4 hours and hospitals would kind of be driven to hit these targets and these numbers. And this was supposed to be good because people weren't waiting so long. But what was actually happening was kind of corridors were filling up with trolleys where people kind of being moved out of A&E after 4 hours, 4 hours, 2 minutes, they kind of got shipped out and were put on a trolley for 8 hours. So it's kind of how these, this kind of measurement kind of culture on the one hand is really, really important. You want your best healthcare, you want kind of evidence-based practice. On the other hand, it's kind of making sure that it doesn't kind of distort kind of a good, humane kind of nursing and healthcare.
Yeah. I mean, in many, I guess, areas of human activity, it just can create very perverse incentives where people try and hit the number and actually lose interest in what the number means and if it's actually helping anyone, including their patients or clients or society, but they kind of hit the number. Another kind of common classic example is from call centres or contact centres where the employee's performance may be measured in terms of how quickly they get through calls. Because what happens and incentivizes them to drop calls.
Yeah.
They don't finish the call. Yeah. Because they're getting measured on that, right? Fine, I will do that. And similarly, say in academia, you might get performance measured by how many papers you publish or what kind of paper. So you just follow that. Now, is that helping your field? Is it advancing human knowledge? Completely different question. You have created this research.
Yeah.
Has it helped anyone, anything in any way? Who knows? But we hit our target. So there's a real perverse thing going on sometimes.
It is. What's you kind of working on at the moment? What's your kind of research or what areas are you working in at the moment, Rob?
Well, I'm now really very much focused on actually evidence-based practice itself. So as the years have gone on, I actually kind of waxed and waned a bit, but I still remain very interested in it, partly because it seems to me that in the field I know a little bit about, it's sort of got a bit better, but not much. Mm-hmm. Some of the reasons I'm talking about. So I'm quite interested in why, although people claim to like evidence-based practice on the whole, apart from you, Simon, but no, lots of people don't. But what they tend to do is either not do it very well, or they sort of say they're doing it and they're not doing it. But also secretly, I think, I think people don't really like it. So there's something about it. And I think that's part of why I still find it interesting. And it can be quite a threat and a challenge to some forms of traditional authority and power.
Yes.
So there's a little bit, sometimes the emperor's new clothes thing here, that people looking at, say, something in a policy-making context or a management context or a you know, psychiatric nursing concept. Everyone's going, wow, isn't this amazing? This new thing, isn't it wonderful? Isn't this person one? Isn't the thing? And you're kind of looking at the data, looking at some other piece of it, and going, no, it is not wonderful. You know, the evidence has not got any clothes on, but it's quite threatening if people want to support certain kinds of ideas and practices and policies. So I'm still interested in that. I'm interested in how people can do it better. And one of my more recent things I'm working on now is trying to produce much more simpler guides and ways of thinking about evidence-based practice that apply right across fields. So you mentioned about your background in medical or medical-related professions. I think when it first got going in medicine, it really put a lot of people off, possibly including you, because it's very much, okay, practitioners, here's some science, here's a nice guideline, just get on with it, mate.
Yeah.
It's like, wait a minute, you have no idea what my life's like, what my world's like, what my patients are like, what my setting is like. It's kind of useful, but there's a lot more to it than that. So I'm interested in how can you get more than that. It's often very technocratic, and it's really kind of fooling people in some way, sometimes with data and numbers and you know, experiments and cool new things. And like, no, it isn't really about that either. And for me, my analogy, my current analogy for this, is it's a bit as though evidence-based practice in general has been a bit like a sort of cordon bleu cookery book, where to start doing it, you already have to know a hell of a lot in the way it's presented about ingredients, cooking techniques, all kinds of stuff, equipment, you know, and most of us couldn't even get started. I'm thinking it needs to be more like, you know, Jamie Oliver's 15-minute meals.
Yes.
Something doable and achievable from where you are now. Because in the end, for me, evidence-based practice is not about making perfect decisions. It's about making more informed decisions. So I'm not interested if it's a less than perfect decision. I'm interested is in if a group of people or an organization or profession typically makes a decision like this, what can we do to help them make them in a bit more of an informed way? Not perfectly, not just using the science, but actually all around better informed decisions. And that's kind of a lot of what I'm interested in at the moment.
That's very interesting. I mean, there's two areas I'm working in at the moment. One, I'm working in a major car manufacturer in the US. And of course, they're still on the production lines and everything is measured to the, you know, like I was blown away. I went to kind of spend 2 days observing their production line work. And it was literally kind of every 15 seconds they were putting in 6 screws, and it was kind of is that time and motion stuff. It's unbelievable to see that kind of still being worked. So kind of science was kind of a massive part of that, and everything had to be done, you know, in a very kind of specific way. And the other sector I've started to work in is a humanitarian sector, which is kind of completely different. And I think it'd be very interesting to get someone like you to come in and have a look at kind of, because it's a very data driven sector from the center. You know, they want kind of results, they want numbers, they want kind of targets. And then at the edges, kind of people working in the field are just struggling, like to kind of make ends meet, and they're trying to sort of do things in a very basically not reactive way, but in a kind of adaptive way, you know, adapting to kind of a precarious kind of world they live in, basically. And these two things...
Both of these examples speak to what I mentioned before, that often the use of evidence and data, in whether it's development or manufacturing, it can be done in a really top-down kind of way, rather than a bottom-up kind of way, rather than evidence on the ground, evidence that's meaningful, evidence that's helping you understand this, you know, what is a problem or issue, what we can do about it. So I think another thing that, to me, is never emphasized enough in any area of evidence-based practice is that people tend to avoid trying to understand what the problem or issue or opportunity is first, and they jump straight into sort of action and doing things.
Yeah.
I think whether it's development or manufacturing, I think you have to say, what is the issue? What is the challenge? What is the opportunity? What are we trying to achieve? And it may be achieved through measuring everything or measuring particular things.
Yeah.
Maybe, but there may be something else you need to do. But starting off saying, what are we trying to do here? And again, another telltale sign, I think quite a lot of this is when people are measuring stuff, if you say to them, well, what would happen if you stop measuring this tomorrow or now? What would happen if you stop measuring it? Typically, people struggle to give you an answer, which is a clue that it's probably not very useful information.
Yeah, and you know, that's my I actually use that kind of a statement quite a lot, because I work a lot in HR and OD fields where the measurement I don't think is actually very you know, people kind of learn how to distort it. They learn how to game the system to kind of get their reports right and stuff, you know. And I think, wow, so much money goes on these kind of engagement surveys and these reports, which is supposed to be given evidence about how people are feeling, when we know that everyone's gaming the system and it's kind of a part of getting your annual bonus at the end of the system. It's,
yeah,
you know, so, you know, there's a massive amount of money spent in this area, which is actually kind of distorting what's going on. So, yeah, I think you're right. Kind of,
and I think what that is about in the case, for example, of engagement and HR stuff, is it's about incentives and it's about people feeling, because they've measured something, they've kind of got an angle on something, because it doesn't mean that at all. But and then I think all these things become embedded in stuff like targets, KPIs, and also what I quite like the metaphor of the dashboard in HR, mm-hmm. that people looking at this data. And again, I'm not an HR practitioner, but having spoken to quite a lot, having some sense of it, what I hear from them, and certainly the more critical ones, is yes, is generating lots of data, they can look at this dashboard, but how much of it is telling them anything useful
or yeah,
insightful yeah. or things that are going to help them as an HR function help the organization better? And the answer seems to be not much of it. So a lot of data, a lot of visual stuff, a lot of graphs, a lot of numbers flying around, but so what? And this is, again, my general point about evidence. Using data and evidence also really requires critical thinking. Always saying, is this good quality? Is it trustworthy? What is it telling me? Is it relevant? And that's hard. Collecting numbers is easy.
Yeah.
Understanding what they're telling you, what they mean, and what you can do about them is really difficult.
Yeah, and that's my experience. And I mean, I just had a thought then that actually quite a lot of the work I observe in the kind of, I'm sorry for my HR and OD colleagues, but quite a lot of the work I observe is when they're trying to do like a big culture change program or kind of a leadership development program, they actually don't know what to do. It's like, how do you change an organization? It's kind of quite a tough gig to change an organization, you know, an organizational culture. So what they revert to is something where they can kind of show that they've done something and show it. Like, you know, you get evidence for yourself that you've done something by producing a load of Excel charts or an engagement survey or something to show that you've kind of been productive yourself, you know, and you're covering your own back, you know. And it's
exactly. A lot of it is activity to justify your own existence. We did lots of stuff. Did it work? I don't know, but look at all the stuff we did. And you hear this again and again and again. And also in the case of, this goes back to my point about critical thinking, in the case of culture, it's one of my kind of bugbears in that often, so for example, the Met Police recently, examples of other organizations where basically employees have been behaving pretty badly.
Yeah.
And there's fairly broad agreement about this. And what people often do is we need to change the culture. So I think it was also in the UK, the CBI as well recently said it was going to change the culture, and saying things like, I can't remember the direct quote, it was something like, we had allowed culturally toxic people to enter the organization. And you're thinking, what on earth does that mean?
Yeah.
Are you serious about managing an organization, or are you just evoking what's a culturally toxic? Just that's what I mean by the thinking.
Yeah.
And again, I've never yet come across an example when managers or senior managers or leaders say they want to change the culture. What they mean is, I want people to behave differently.
Yes.
And tackling that is really hard.
Yeah.
And requires a lot of thought, critical thinking and data. But saying, oh, change the culture is actually relatively easy, because you can, you know, bring in some culture experts, you can have a new mission statement, you could, but then what does that mean? You're not interested in culture, you're interested in the behavior. So why not tackle the behavior? Because it's almost too, yeah, it's just another way of putting it, it's like it's just kicking the can down the road, I think.
It is, yeah, and you know, changing culture is really tough. Like, it, you know, I've been a therapist, and like changing an individual is kind of an individual actually what comes to therapy and wants to change, they find it hard enough. You know, you're going to be in there for years trying to change your own behavior. Like, to change a kind of whole organization is not an easy gig. You, the other thing I came across in Lancaster University was some scholars who talked about the difference between kind of explanation science, explanatory science, and science which is just replication. So you get kind of hard sciences is trying to reproduce kind of results, you know, this is kind of your studies. Do you where does explanational science come into kind of the evidence-based work to try and sort of understand more? You've talked quite a bit about that. How does it kind of fit into the evidence-based piece?
So obviously, from a scientific point of view, replication is very important, as indeed is replication is very important in any kinds of, when you think about reliability of any kinds of data. So even just an example like, okay, I wonder what time the number 33 bus goes down the end of our street. It's 3 o'clock. I'll walk down there and see if it comes. And if it comes, that's possibly when it comes. And if it doesn't, then that's not when it comes. Then you walk back home. Fine. That's a test of one. It doesn't tell you very much. And in relation to science as well, one study just doesn't tell you very much. And certainly all the fields like management, HR, organizational psychology, psychology in general, there's a real issue with replication.
Yeah.
In that it isn't done very much. And indeed in my field, if you want to do completely straight replication, so I'm really going to try and completely repeat this other study, it wouldn't get published because people are looking for originality, whatever that means. Science has its own problems as well around being, so science itself is not very evidence-based in its own practice, I would say. So replication is important. but at the same time, yes, you're right, you also need theory, you need explanation. So often things that pass for explanation, such as models, certainly a lot of sort of quantitative research, not only quantitative, they're just sort of descriptions. They're not really kind of explanations. And again, I think it comes down to that process of things like imagination, creativity, and critical thinking.
Yeah.
That will start to help you think through how can we've seen some data, we think we've seen things happening, but how can we understand and explain why that might be happening?
Yeah.
And that is a key part of, I think, any evidence-based practice. I mean, unless you've got absolutely brilliant data for the whole process, which is kind of unusual, there's always kind of gaps. So even if you look at, say, in the case of HR, the case of attrition, people are leaving, people are quitting, fine, you've got the data. Fine, you can correlate it with something like their engagement score, which may or may not be linked. It still doesn't tell you about why.
No, no.
And that's where, again, this sort of this idea of critical thinking, I think comes in much more. But typically, you're right, I think there is this sort of distinguish between kind of the dust bowl empiricist, let's get every single piece of information and data we can, and eventually we'll just know everything, just keep collecting the data, versus, no, wait a minute, that doesn't help, because you need theories, you need to think about why and how things are happening, and only then does the data you've got start to become useful and make sense. So there is this kind of quite a battle between this kind of empirical and rational, as it's sometimes called, epistemology as well.
Yeah, no, I think it's and people that don't even question the difference, I think. So I think the big takeaway from this is very much around the addition of critical thinking, critical theory to kind of a question that sort of grounded up start, you know, don't add on a kind of a evidence-based study to show what you want it to show, kind of start being...
It's critical thinking, and it's multiple sources of evidence.
Yeah.
It's thinking about reliability and trustworthiness and relevance, and is actually trying to pull all that together and focusing on what is the issue, or problem, or opportunity first, and only when that's fairly clear, focus on what should we do about it. And wrapped around all of this, of course, is nuance. It depends, maybe. You know, a lot of people find it depends a fairly unsatisfactory answer. I think it's, in general, I think it's kind of the answer to most questions, you know.
Yeah.
Do you want a pizza? It depends. Who's making the pizza? What kind of pizza? What kind of mood am I in? Who am I going to eat the pizza? You know.
Yeah.
Other things, maybe you just go yes or no to straight away, but usually that nuance, that, yeah, it depends, is a very important part of it.
Do you have any kind of a case that has come to mind, examples of evidence-based work which has really made a big difference, you can think of, which kind of changed, really was a big game changer?
Yeah, I don't, certainly not in the fields I work in, because I think the challenge is, there's certainly, you know, you could argue some quite high quality scientific evidence around. There's certainly in organisations sometimes some really good sort of people analytics and good data stuff. But what is often missing is pulling all those bits together. And I think to your question about the something that really made a difference, I think it also might be quite in that particular setting it will make a difference. So back to your point about what counts as evidence and data, often a kind of case study would not be seen as very strong evidence of the efficacy of evidence-based practice. But I would say certainly in organizational context, it probably is always a case that is always depending on the organization, because they're having to pull these threads together.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a good example, though I've often been asked that question, because you have to really get in on the ground and look at what people were doing with a particular issue in a particular context in a particular organization.
Sure. Local and specific always, yeah. Rob, this has been really, really interesting. We're going to end up, and I asked my guests two questions, just if they got any tips to the audience around what it takes to live a good life and what it means to live, to create the good society. Big questions. Any thoughts on what it means to live a good life and to create a good society?
Well, yeah. I think I'm not sure what a good life means, but I think a starting point is to think critically about that, about what it might mean either for you and for other people. And it part of, I guess, what a good life means is thinking about more broad about what a good society means. And for me, I think partly based on my own political views, but also things I understand about inequality and stuff like that, it seems to me a good society, a cornerstone of it is to think about inequality equality in all its meanings. I know it's a confusing term in some ways, but it seems to me certainly, for example, in the UK and lots of other countries I have some awareness of, inequality kind of was getting better and now it feels like it's getting worse again. And there's reasons for that. And, they're slightly disturbing reasons. But I think fundamentally, it's, of course, much more than about being nice to people.
Yes.
I think it's really thinking about the power and resources that people have and accepting there are going to be variations, of course. A centrist dad coming out here. There are going to be variations, of course, in how much people have. But the idea that it should be so big is definitely the opposite, I think, of this idea.
Yeah. Rob, thank you very much for your thoughts. It's been really, really interesting. You've convinced me there's a place for evidence-based work. I'm going to invite you to work with us in the humanitarian sector. I think it'd be very interesting to have some discussions with you around work. So go well. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.